Do I need to hold this?
You will, yeah.
All right, TC.
Hey!
Hang on a minute. Just hold it. Hold it. Hold everything and go.
Hello, everybody out there in Santa Cruz Waves world. Welcome to the 418th Off the Lip radio show live from the Santa Cruz boardroom. We're busy as can be right now. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, everything is, we're cranking on all cylinders right now. Tonight's show is a special show. As you know, we're in the middle of an election right now. There's some great heated battles. You can see I got my vote sticker on there. Yes, I do. Yep, so please, everybody vote. That is the most powerful thing you can do. And tonight our guest is John Laird, running for Senator of Santa Cruz and San Luis Obispo counties, correct, John?
And Monterey and Southern Santa Clara.
And Salinas is involved in this?
No, they're just outside.
Oh, they're just outside. Okay, and yeah. What district is that?
17.
17. Okay, so everybody, John is in the 17th district. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The last time you were here, we asked you, why are you
what the hell are you doing?
Enough to get back in politics? So let's start so that the viewers can have a little idea of your background, so they can get a determination of how you got here. Also, anybody listening on Santa Cruz Waves, if you have questions, we're going to try to follow along with the social media aspect of the show, and you're welcome to jump in and ask any questions as well. But let's get to the beginning of this, John. Let us know like how you got into politics.
Well, I was in the fourth full class at UC Santa Cruz. I was an honors graduate in politics, and that's what they actually called it. But I volunteered on campaigns. I did a thesis on the history of water development in California, not realizing I was making a career decision that I will never be far from water policy the whole time.
Is that a major?
No, it was politics. In politics, I was allowed to do it. And it was great. It's the reason I got honors at graduation, not necessarily the coursework up to that. And I got a job immediately working for a member of Congress who was working on water issues. And I left Santa Cruz for 2 years, and then I came back and got hired by the county administrator and did the county's health and social services budget, worked with nonprofits, got elected to the city council when I was 31, served 9 years, 2 terms as mayor, was on the transit board, transportation commission, for 9 years, and it was an amazing time. We had the storm of 82.
Oh, great
after
storm.
I had been on the council for 6 weeks, and we had the earthquake when I had 13 months to go, so it was bookended by fundamental disasters in Santa Cruz. I ran the Santa Cruz AIDS Project for the height of the epidemic. I went back to work for the county. I served 8 years on the Cabrillo Board of Trustees. I was elected to the Assembly in 2002, served 6 years, the mandatory term limits kicking in, was budget chair, had 82 bills signed into law, represented the north half of the Senate district, taught a class at UCSC, served in the Waste Board, and then Jerry Brown appointed me to his cabinet as Secretary for Natural Resources, because apparently I am disaster prone. So I happened to have the 4 years of the drought and be the point person for water. I had dams, and we had Orville Dam. I had Cal Fire, and we had a few minor fires in that period. And the minute I worked for Gavin Newsom for 1 day, came back full time and have been running for the Senate ever since, and feel really up for it, prepared, have an amazing background.
You know, most people would kind of think, I'm going to just slide off.
Yeah.
And because I've done it.
Right.
Because you're just back in the fire.
Well, the thing about it is we talked off mic beforehand because we both have 96-year-old mothers. I'm not sitting around for 25 or 30 years with nothing to do when I'm on the top of my game.
Right.
I really feel like, and right now, I was joking, Jack O'Connell, who is the state schools chief, is a good friend of mine, and he's a supporter, and he's in San Luis Obispo. He did an event for me via Zoom a couple of weeks ago, and he said, why are you running? And I said, well, when I announced, it seemed like such a good idea at the time, you know, because there was no COVID, there was no economic downturn. We hadn't headed into this. The state had a $17 billion surplus. Now, and of course, we've had the big fire here.
Right.
We have challenges.
Right. You took the last 10 years off, correct?
No. I worked until 2 years ago for Jerry Brown, or
okay.
Under 2 years ago. Yes. Oh, no. Believe me, that 8 years as a cabinet was not taken off.
Right. Are you still excited as you are, as it seems like as you are today, is at the beginning when you decided to get into politics? Is it still?
Yes.
Are you having any fun?
I am having fun. You shouldn't be doing this if you're not having fun. And I think the interesting thing is when I was in the legislature, I thought, God, I love getting a bill signed. I love major policy. I love driving things the way they need to be driven. I love helping the people at home. But if I could get a good line off in public, I was thrilled. And it would happen. There would be certain times where it would just be set right up and you could just knock it right out and nobody would see it coming. And so you gotta have fun, because just because you're serious of purpose doesn't mean you have to be serious all the time.
Out of the 82 bills that you've passed, what was the most rewarding for you?
There were a couple. One of them was... I authored the creation of the Sierra Nevada Conservancy. And there's a funny story there. I had to take an amendment I didn't want to take. Governor Schwarzenegger said, I want the Secretary of Resources to be on the board. And I was like, I don't want that. But finally, I take it. Then, lo and behold, I become the Secretary of Resources, and I'm on the board of my favorite organization because of an amendment I had to take that I didn't want to take.
Oh, wow.
You know, and it is at the forefront of the Sierra Conservancy of a lot of the forestry work and the fire prevention work all through the Sierra now. And the real idea was we have a coastal conservancy here. There's places, Santa Monica Mountains, where it's a focus for environmental protection, but in some cases economic development. Right. And the Sierra just didn't have it.
Right.
And so this runs from Kern County all the way to the Oregon border, and it really draws money into the Sierra for environmental protection that wouldn't be there otherwise.
Right.
And they are taking the lead in figuring out how to restore certain watersheds, how to deal with the tree mortality, fire, different things. And so I'm really proud that they're there,
right?
Because I really spearheaded the effort.
That's amazing.
Can I ask? Okay, so you're going back to, you're going to win. We think TC and I think you're going to win.
I'm not taking anything for
granted. No, not at all.
But it's
not just that's just us. But your briefcase. When you head back to Sacramento with your briefcase, what's in that briefcase? What things are you going to be? What's the five or six things that's most important that's in that briefcase that you're taking with you to go work on?
Well, you know, it's changed in the last few months. I really featured in the primary and still believe in fighting climate and doing all the things that come from climate change. We're going to have the sea go up here. And I spearheaded the science on that when I was in the Brown administration, and some of the guidance for what to do. The marine protected areas, I was sort of instrumental in that last piece and stabilizing that. There are things like that I want to work on. But I think the fires are just front and center, because we did things like the first CAL FIRE units to do prescribed burn or controlled fires. And we did money for 250,000 acres of forest management. And we did an environmental impact report that was statewide, so local people can do fire, like forest management easier without having to go through excessive environmental review. But now there's rebuilding. The fire season starts a month earlier and goes a month longer than a generation ago. We don't have enough resources. The fact I was in there was 4 days here when they were not fighting the fire, when they were just getting people out.
Right.
And on the second morning, I think of the second day, I thought, what do I have to lose? And I just started pounding everybody I knew in Sacramento about resources. One poor guy in a position of authority says to me, well, we have a million acres on fire, and we have these two fires of 300,000 acres. And I said, yeah, and one of them's threatening 12 homes. We have 77,000 people out. It's aimed at 60 more. It's burning through residential areas. Get your priorities right.
Right.
You know, and I think that what happens if that's going to be the norm, we had 1,000 acres burn in California from something like 1920 to 1999, 1,000 acres total. We had 1,000 acres on fire this year,
right.
And 4 million in total have burned. And so this is the new normal. And so what are we going to do? And it's two things. It's climate changing everything dramatically, But in about the 1920s in California, they decided to do heavy fire suppression. And so fires did not burn through forests in a lot of places. And as a result, there's built up fuel. I mean, Cal Fire was telling me when I talked to them at one point about certain places in Bonnie Doon and in that part of Santa Cruz County, they said, there's never been a fire here. So it's like there has never been ability to clean up any of the fuel.
But after the Paradise Fire, surely that woke people up as far as Bonnie Doon or Boulder Creek and go, you know, that it's going to happen.
On some level, people think it will never quite happen to them. And I got to confess, we were packed and ready to go in West Santa Cruz because it was just the city fire department at the city limits.
Right.
I never thought in a million years, as a Santa Cruz resident on the west side, I would have to think of evacuating sometime. That just didn't occur to me. And so there is a catch-up in public opinion. And if you go back to Paradise, we thought when the Brown administration was ending, we would have these 2 months where we would ease out the door. And the Paradise Fire happened, I think, the week after the election. And we spent the last 2 months before we turned it over to Gavin Newsom just focused on that.
Yeah.
I was up there 4 or 5 times, and I might have talked about it a little bit the previous time I was here, but they, in Paradise, they knew. And so they actually had an evacuation plan that they did as an entire city, where they evacuated in quadrants, and they figured out in an orderly way. They didn't know that this fire was going to burn at whatever it was, 60 acres a minute, so that people couldn't even outrun it.
They literally got out of their cars and ran.
Yeah, and a lot of them didn't quite make it. And there's this one, I think I told the story last time because it was really powerful to me. I was with the Cal Fire chief in the week after the fire, and we are riding through Paradise. And there is this huge shopping center in the middle. It had one of those big Safeways that burnt completely to the ground. Everything's to the ground, and there's this drugstore. I think it's a Rite Aid, and it was just right in the middle, and it was still standing. And I said to him, talk to me. What happened here? And he said, well, there are about 100 or 125 people that were trapped in this area. They couldn't get out, and there were 3 fire trucks trapped. So they put everybody in that drugstore. They faced the fire trucks out, and they defended the drugstore when the fire went through. And it was so bad that they were running in and getting fire extinguishers off the shelves for the spot fires. But they defended the drugstore, and they saved all those people. And they said, he said, our ethic is always just get out. That just something like that happens, get out. But he says, in that case, that was the safest thing to do.
Right.
You know, because there were power lines, trees were down over roads, people couldn't move or get out. And so I think it's tough because it's like anything. Sea level rise is part of it. It's rising, but it's that one extreme event, and nobody thinks it's as threatening until that one extreme event. When the tsunami from Japan hit the Santa Cruz Harbor, it was before sea level rise, at low tide. So imagine if we have 6 or 8 inches and it's high tide and we have some event, a big storm with storm surges, another tsunami, it's a totally different thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think it's bringing the public along. And the one thing this fire did is the public is now, I think, across Santa Cruz County is there.
Right. Yeah, they all realize that there's a huge problem with forest fires.
Yes. And it's really defensible space, having an exit plan, whatever jargon you use, cleaning the forests or, you know, forest management. And if I can just make one gratuitous political comment.
Sure.
Nothing makes me crazier than the President of the United States saying rake the forest. Because in California, 57% of the forests are in federal and 2% are state. And it's like, so I got quoted in the Monterey paper saying, you want to know who's responsible? Get out a mirror, plant it firmly in front of your face, look directly into it.
Right.
Mr. President, then you will see who's responsible for 57% of the forests in California. And the fire that burned out of Shaver Lake toward Yosemite was entirely dead trees in federal forests. And so you talk about cleaning. And I don't want to represent it was easy. There were 140 million dead trees out of the drought in those first 4 years of this decade when the drought hit. And you can't deal with 140 million trees, so it had to be prioritized. So right. It was like next to roadways, next to power lines, next to inhabited areas. Those were the first priorities to try to deal with the dead trees. And I think in the first year, they could take we could take down 2 million, but there were 140 million.
Right. I just wanted to back up a little bit because India Kerr asked a question here on Santa Cruz Waves. And it's super basic, and we did not address it. And she says, I believe, is he Democrat, Republican, or independent?
I'm a Democrat.
There you go, India. You got the answer straight from the horse's mouth.
So don't forget to let people know. You can ask questions by writing them into Santa Cruz Waves. You're watching on Facebook right now. You can just jot down a question, and TC's reading them.
We got people listening from Indonesia, Peru tonight. I mean,
We just ask the people to be respectful, and that's all we ask.
No, I've been to both Indonesia and Peru. Hey. It'd be nice to be to either one.
Well, you got fans there.
So fires. We talked about fires. What else is on the agenda that you're going to tackle?
It goes without saying that affordable housing in this area is a big deal, and it's really hard.
Does that seem like I don't know about UTC, but you've been in your house for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Affordable housing.
Both of my children had to leave town. Especially now with this work at home thing that's going on. A house sells in a day for $100,000 over asking and stuff right now.
Is that a bit of a dead end street, or
there's things you can do, but they're always not. They always present some obstacles because the real thing is the question of whether you want an increased density in places, and the general public thinks we really support increased densities, just not right around me, and so you have that problem, and you have the problem of fees and the process and moving in some ways, and for housing to be affordable, somewhere there has to be some money or some assistance that helps. And the federal government, when I was on the Santa Cruz City Council, which is in Jurassic times, I was on from 81 to 90, there were 700 units of affordable housing built in Santa Cruz during those years. But there were these federal streams of money and things that would help a developer that really wanted to do it. And I am hoping that there'll be a shift in the federal government in the next election, and that they'll want to get back in the playing field and help with the affordability of housing across the country.
My theory on it, sorry Neil to interrupt, is making the ADUs easier and to make it easier if it's not an Airbnb. The permitting process is
Been an ADU streamlining that's passed, and I'm aware of it because I'm on the verge of deciding to do one myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it may be an art studio for the first few years, since I am married to an artist who's craving an art studio. But it will be an ADU, and there'll be a point at which it is perfectly there, and the processes and the fees are streamlined because it is one place that you can do more housing relatively easily. I mean, we have different issues, and Scott Weiner, who is a senator, who's a friend of mine, he's endorsed me, he did the bill that wants to completely override local land use, and I have said I don't support that unless there's a guarantee that some of it's affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to just see how that will do. And in this district, we have different issues. In Monterey, they have a de facto water moratorium. In Santa Cruz, we have the university, and the more they increase students and don't provide housing for them, the more it puts pressure on the housing market in town and surrounding areas. And so there are different issues if we figure out how to make or help UC provide housing for students on campus. It is an issue for town. If we can figure out how to do a reliable water source in Monterey, it will help them get to some additional housing. But it's not easy. It's not just Scott said once, and I argued with him. He said, you build the housing, the infrastructure will come. And it's like, not so easy. We don't import water in Santa Cruz or Monterey. You just can't assume that everything is just there, you know. So there are problems to work out, and yet the issue is exactly what you said about your kids. I mean, it's not fair for kids to have to leave where they grew up because it's simply inaccessible, that the housing market is out of reach.
If you line up 10 developers here, we'd speak to each one of them. Do you think they're looking after their pocketbook, or are they concerned about affordable housing?
It's a mix.
You think really?
It's a mix. And but the thing about it is they're no dummies. If they do affordable housing, they want it to pencil out for them. And so the question is how to do that. And there are, when I was on the city council, we did what's known as inclusionary housing, which is that a certain percentage of housing has to be affordable in any development that was 8 or 10 units or more. It had to be, I think, 15%. There's a debate over 20. And a subsequent city council repealed part of it because the developers hated it. They felt like it was two tiers of housing, and they said, just allow us pay into a fund. And then nobody could find land. There were no projects. So this fund grew in money, and you couldn't buy much in it. And all these, not a lot, but projects were built without the inclusionary. And I always thought, I know it's uncomfortable for the developers, but it's like, we did it. We want to know that every time we construct housing, a measure of it will be affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And the one example, I took some heat in the primary because there was one piece of legislation in Sacramento that said you get an expedited process if you provide a certain percent of affordable housing. Well, that was the percent of affordable housing that was already required in the city and county of Santa Cruz. And so the developers, some were very happy because it would expedite the process, but they were already doing that. And I had the audacity to say in public, well, it could be additive. You could add the thing and require more. And it was like, you're blowing up the project. You're anti-affordable housing. And yet, when the St. George was rebuilt after the earthquake in Santa Cruz, I'm not going to get the numbers exactly right because it's 30 years ago, but I was on the council. And they came to us, and they wanted something originally like 20% affordable housing. And by the time we were done, I think they did 45% affordable housing, but there were some federal funding streams that reimbursed them for some of it that don't exist now.
Mm.
But I thought that's what the council is supposed to do.
Right.
You are supposed to, on a case-by-case basis, get as much as you can for the affordable housing because that's the issue right now. And so, and it's not easy, but it's there was a bill that died in the last minutes of session, and this session was weird this year because of COVID and the Assembly and the Senate being mad at each other and all these dysfunctional things, but that would have allowed a higher zoning on corners, that you could have maybe as much as a fourplex if a corner was a certain size, and it died in the last minutes, but everybody supported it. I think it will come back in the next session, and that might be a way.
Yeah.
I've become really aware of it again, so that when I walk or drive around, I see where there's a fourplex tucked in a block and you can't tell. And I always remember there's this one block, I think it's where Fred Keeley lives. It goes up
Market Street.
Yeah, Market Street from Water. And I remember once when I was on the city council and I'm walking that precinct and I think, oh, thank God, just a block and a half left. And I don't realize there's four units behind every single house.
Right.
And it took me forever to get off that street, you know, because I went to each one. And yet you don't know. It backs onto a creek. You can't tell, and I think people would be impressed
right.
at how that is a quality of life for living and yet still a higher density in the middle of a city, but that's the challenge.
And that's a great challenge because I think that's the future of affordable housing
is
to have small entry-level housing.
Well, tiny homes.
ADU, fourplexes. You know, there was a project being built behind the shop here. And they basically negotiated a deal to where he could add a few more apartments if he added a couple of more affordables. And they worked back and forth until the deal penciled out. And I think that's the kind of future we have to make these projects work, because you're 100% correct on needing more affordable housing, and more so right now than ever. But I did want to change it up a little bit.
Yeah, man.
Is it true you're a Chicago Cubs fan?
Oh, yes.
Big time, right?
Yeah. Thank you for 20% of the people that have voted already and didn't know that beforehand.
Yeah, right.
Well, my dad was from about 2.5 hours south of Chicago. And it's very interesting because back in those days when he was a kid or younger or grew up, there were only 8 teams in the National League. And they were not that far from St. Louis. And so I think his mother was a Cubs fan with him. His father was a Cardinals fan. 2 siblings were Cardinals fans, and another sibling was a Cubs fan with him, and they were divided.
And that's a big
up.
Rivalry, the Cubs versus the
exactly.
Cardinals, right?
And the other thing was is that he came out to California with my mom right about the time I was born, and it was 7 or 8 years before the Dodgers or Giants arrived in California. So they did that when I was 8. I was committed. I was a Cubs fan.
Right.
And then I was probably the only kid in my elementary school that wasn't a Giants fan. It was really, it really tested your mettle. And of course, they had a really brutal 60 years or whatever it is.
The curse.
And they gave the night they won, the morning after they won the championship in 2016, the next morning was a cabinet meeting. And I said to the governor's chief of staff, okay, give me the first 2 or 3 minutes here. And and I sort of said, I've been taking a lot of crap from you guys.
For many years.
And it's like, the last time the Cubs won a world championship, Theodore Roosevelt was president. And if it weren't for, I'm trying to remember who, the guy in Meet the Press, he says, no, it's the only time. The two times they won championships were both when Theodore Roosevelt was president.
Oh, wow.
The last time they won the pennant was the year my father married my mother, and he'd just come back from Europe in World War II, and he was in Wrigley Field for opening day and saw the pennant go up the last time. He was in the outfield in San Diego when they lost the playoffs. The home run was hit right at him by, you know, one of the San Diego players that beat the Cubs. It was like, don't get greedy. You guys had all these championships. We get nothing, you know.
I got a question about Cubs stats. So this you'll know if you're really a true fan.
Uh-oh.
Who's the all-time home run leader of the Chicago Cubs?
Mm. Is it Stan Hack?
Nope.
Who is it?
Sammy Sosa.
Sammy Sosa,
of course.
Yeah.
Of course. I'm going old.
Yep. Well,
I'm going old.
It reminds me.
My hero when I was a kid, the one I should have guessed, was Ernie Banks. And I remember when I met him and got his autograph when I was about 10, it was like one of the big days of my life.
Ernie Banks, right.
Yeah. You know, it was just cool. And one of the funny things was is my dad's been gone for a while now, but he never got anything out of me being in elected office. And so I was mayor, and they were having a cable TV dinner here. And Tony Hill, who you might remember, was the cable TV guy at the time. And he said, you know, our special guest is Lou Brock. And I said, you know, I never bring anybody. Can I bring somebody? Yeah, you know, and when he heard, he says, oh, of course. And so he seats my dad next to Lou Brock at this dinner. And I walk over, and I remember my dad saying something like, you remember on July 13th of this year, you hit a home run that was like, and he says some number, and he goes, oh, no, it was not 548, it was 552. And they are just off to the races. They are just going, and it was like one of the best things I ever did was my dad getting sit next to Lou Brock for a dinner. And, you know, and because that trade, there was another Cubs thing. They traded Lou Brock to the Cardinals for a pitcher that went out of baseball the next year. And then Lou Brock's, I think, in the Hall of Fame. And he did all this stuff. And it was like, what were they doing?
The curse of the Cubs.
Yeah.
One of my favorite guests who comes in every year is Billy Miller. And Billy Miller lives in Aptos. He's a major league umpire. A crew chief. He's been doing it for 25 years. Have you met Billy?
No, I haven't met him, but I know
he can
he
still sit here and tell stories.
Oh, he's a great storyteller.
Blue until you blow in the face. Baseball stories. But I never forget. I asked him, the first show he came on, so what's your favorite stadium? You know, come on, you've been in them all. What's your favorite stadium? And he said, piece of cake, Wrigley Field. I'm like, oh, yeah. You know, Wrigley Field, the Ivy, you know, Harry Carey. He goes, I don't give a shit about any of that. I go, why Wrigley Field? He goes, if that game's over at like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I don't get out of there till 3, I can still get a beer.
Oh, no, I would have thought it was the other stuff. You know, the thing was so the Democratic National Convention was in Chicago in 1996, and the convention is always Monday to Thursday. And I'm a delegate, and the Cubs are returning home for a doubleheader Friday. So a couple of friends of mine from San Diego and I, we get tickets about 20 rows behind home plate for this doubleheader, and it's a beautiful day. It's in the 70s. They're just serving beer. You can't drive there, so it's wonderful. You could just do whatever you want. And I had to call back. I think it was to KUSP at the time. And I thought, well, I'll find a phone booth in Wrigley. And so it's nearing the seventh inning of the first game, And I go under, and I get them on the line. I'm just starting to talk to them, and somehow the Cubs erupt. And that is such a small stadium
right.
that I cannot hear. I'm live on the radio, and I cannot hear
but
the other
care,
thing.
You
and,
care.
And they said to me at KUSP, where are you?
Was that loud?
Yeah, and I didn't want to sort of say, I'm in Wrigley Field, where you're never far away from the field or anywhere.
Right.
When I was a kid, we spent, I think I was nine, and we spent the summer back with my grandmother. We drove across from California, and my dad took us up regularly. And in those days, Wrigley had, P.K. Wrigley, the owner of the Cubs, was a cheapskate. And so he didn't want to lose the foul balls. So there was this net from the second balcony down to the screen in the first, and they would have the sound. A foul ball would hit, and it would roll, and they would just go, ooh, you know, the whole crowd together. It was just a ritual, and PK created this ritual, and he never lost a ball and had to pay for a new one.
Wow.
And, you know, it was an amazing thing.
That's
know?
Incredible.
So it's great lore, and there are certain people in town.
Yeah.
You know, if I ever run into Jeff Dunn, he has immediately what the Cub news is.
Right,
you know,
right.
So it's a good thing.
I want to move into the Senate.
Let's.
Because As a normal human being, I look at it and I feel it's the jocks versus the surfers or something. You know, like it's so far apart when you look at the GOP and what's going on. And are you
prepared
for
that?
Well,
at the state, it's a little different,
yes.
And it's a different for an odd reason. It is still exactly what you say. Maybe it's the jocks and the surfers, but now the Republicans are such a non-factor. 40 members of the Senate, they have 11, and they're in danger of going as low as 7 in this election. So we could have 33 Democrats and 7, and you'd think, oh, more than two-thirds, unanimity, all this stuff. Ugh. It's like there's the moderate Democrats and the more environmental progressive Democrats,
right.
And there are splits. This existed to some extent when I was in the Assembly, and I tell the story that one time I did this really tough civil rights bill, and I thought when I get down to the end, it's going to be tough getting to 41 votes. There's 48 Democrats. So in January, when you introduce bills, and you're 6 or 7 months before that last day of session, this is the time to do it. So I went to 2 or 3 moderates and convinced them this was for them and get them to be co-authors so that when it comes to the end, I will be good. And this bill, which is really hard, goes up, and it gets 40 votes, and it needs 41. And I'm looking at who's voted, and I finally went back to this guy, and I said, you know, you just voted against this bill. You're a co-author of this bill.
Right.
You know, and he was mildly embarrassed, and he looked for a couple of minutes to save face, and then he quietly switches, and the bill gets out, you know. And it's particularly acute in the Assembly right now, not as much in the Senate. And so you have to sort of game it. And that's the thing. The other thing is when I was there, there was strong leadership. And now, particularly in the Assembly, the Speaker has decided to empower all the committee chairs and not do much control over them. So you have about 13 little fiefdoms. And so that's going to be a challenge to work. I'm going to do it, and
right.
I'm going to try to make it work. But there's a whole different obstacle course. And it's I used to do this thing, apropos of your original question, is I would always know every session the new members that were Democrats coming in, but I wouldn't know the Republicans. So I would go and spend a half hour with every new Republican at the beginning of me, and it led to great things. We talked about the Sierra Nevada Conservancy.
Yep.
I ended up doing that as a compromise with a conservative Republican from the Sierra, and I did various bills where I had a Republican co-author, and I tried to navigate them together. And it's a lost art these days in the polarization. A lot of people that are capital lookers say, we loved you for that. We're going to be really curious to see if you can pull it off in the current environment.
And it seems like that should almost be required, that everybody gets together and has one-on-ones of that nature. Just
well, you
the,
see,
like
it's
the
not,
introduction.
This is the genuine art of legislating. And I think it is, if you know what you want to do and you're a legislator that's navigating, you you know when it becomes too weak or too watered down that even you don't want to go ahead with it. So it's like, okay, I'm going to accomplish this. And is there a way that I can, like, take into account your concerns while doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times there's, you know, it'll cost too much, or somebody didn't take into account how it affected one district, or there's different things, and so you try to work with that,
right,
to figure out how to get it done.
Do you have to get an apartment in Sacramento?
I have a condo.
Oh, you have a condo up there?
Thank God I have never sold.
Yeah.
Because it is 2 blocks from where my office was when I was resources secretary, and it's 2 blocks from the Capitol, and it's the closest you can live and own a place.
Wow.
And when I bought it 17 years ago, it was $155,000, and they said, for a two-bedroom, two-bath condo. And they said, we're really sorry. These were just $100,000 last year. And I was like, are you kidding? Back home, I couldn't get a garden shed for this.
Well, that's great to hear that you have that, because you got to spend a lot of – well, and is it different now? Are you planning to have less time there?
No.
Because of COVID?
When you're in session – well, I don't know what COVID will do. It's – I'm contemplating the fact that if I'm elected, I might have to put together a staff and set up an office in an office I can't go into. And I don't know how you do that, because I built a team when I was in the assembly. I took Fred Keeley's staff almost to a person and kept them. And I did not have much turnover in 6 years. And they knew the district. They worked for somebody in leadership. I was the new person to the team, but we did really well. And so I didn't have to build this team spirit the way I will have to do this time. So it's going to be interesting. And I don't want to jinx it, but I'm talking to a chief of staff, but I don't want to jinx it. I think this is, you really wait till the people weigh in,
what,
and then you decide to do
it. What's your position on COVID? What are you, you know, how are you tackling it as state senator? How are you going into it? And how are we doing here in Santa Cruz? It's obviously, it's different to Monterey. It's a difference in numbers.
We're doing a little better in Santa Cruz, yeah, than in Monterey. And I think the tough thing was is that the pedal was to the metal the first 3 months, and I think we loosened it too quickly. And we needed to knock it back completely, and now we're in this position that there's all these businesses that are hanging by a thread or have gone under. And because the federal government's gridlocked and they won't extend the business stuff and they won't extend the extra unemployment benefits, it's a nightmare for people that are hit by this. It's just a nightmare.
Right.
And I am hoping that if nothing else, Election Day breaks the gridlock at the federal level and they can figure out how to get money to support state and local governments and that extra bit in unemployment for people that are really struggling, because we have to do that to be able to lock down COVID and make sure that people don't crash too much in this economy.
Right.
And it's, the feds can print money, the state can't.
Yeah.
So that's the difference.
Are you frustrated by how our president is handling this?
Well, I appreciate the fact that you think he's handling it.
Well, I
am baffled by it. I am completely, how he could get COVID after 7 months of this epidemic when his guy says on nationwide TV, wear a mask, that's the one thing you can do. He doesn't wear a mask, he gets infected, and everybody's looking to him for leadership. And he didn't do the centralized leadership, because in the beginning, why are states bidding against each other for protective equipment? That's ridiculous,
right.
That's taxpayers' money. And there needed to be a national leadership that way, and it was just missing, and it was just all, and if he were right here and I said that, he would be attacking whatever my grades were in fifth grade. It would be all this stuff rather than face the fact that it's like, come on, this is the time you do your best work.
And it's interesting, we were talking about this last week on the show, I recently took a trip to Mexico. They are way more organized than America. I mean, I was shocked how every single person is on the same team with the same goal, and they're going to do it the same way. They're going to wear masks, and they're going to wear visors, and they're going to wash hands, and they're going to social distance, and they're going to have tables set up that are apart from each other. And it was universal. The cab drivers are wearing them. Everybody wears a mask there. And it was so shocking to me.
And yeah, it's because we're missing here, and the fact that some people are like, oh, no, it's my civil rights. It's like, come on. There should not be a partisan divide on public health. I mean, I've been waiting to run into this friend of mine on the West Side who's from Vancouver, because there was this great cartoon last week, because Canada equally is facing into this in a good way. And there was this cartoon about how now Canada knows what it's like to have an apartment over a meth lab.
Well, exactly. Well, I mean, to me, I'm frustrated. I'm really frustrated when he brags that he's doing a great job because really 2 million people should be dead or something. You know, and you're like, come on, dude.
Yeah, we should we should not have 215,000.
But you're right. We took the we were doing good there for a while. Where we locked down and it seemed like things were improving, and then everything got let off.
Well, you see,
the gas off the gas.
I get it because people were pressuring Gavin Newsom and other people to open up. It's like businesses were dying, and it was this clash between economics and public health, and yet. Unless we get on top of public health, we will not get on top of the economics. And that's the tough thing. So the question is what can we do to try to keep everybody from going under while we're getting on top of it? And we failed to get on top of it. So it's just a
it was wear a mask.
Yes, exactly.
You know, that's all it was.
I know.
You know, it was that simple. And unfortunately, he wanted to call it a hoax. And then he gets it.
Well, I think that it is really put right front and center in the election that different. I mean, geez, two nights before it announced he has a positive thing, he's raking Joe Biden over in the debate for wearing a mask. I mean, really? It's like,
yeah.
It couldn't be more graphic. And I think it was interesting. I read an article in the Washington Post this morning that he tumbled in the polls out of that first debate and the diagnosis, and he has never recovered. And it's not like he was in good shape before that.
Right.
But that, I mean, this poll came out that he's behind in Georgia, that it's neck and neck in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that he just finally hit a place where the public isn't buying totally. Although, I had Leon, I'm trying to do these unique fundraisers because I think a Zoom fundraiser has the potential to be completely boring. And so I did a California trivia with the state librarian, but a couple of weeks ago I interviewed Leon Panetta for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. People tuned in and they saw this. And one of the things was I said, you know, when I was mayor and you were running for re-election one year, you got 90% of the vote in the city of Santa Cruz. And did we think that's revolutionary in a partisan race? No, we wanted to know who the 10% were.
Well, Leon's an amazing human.
He really is.
Yeah. I mean, what an honor to be able to sit down with him for an hour. We'd love to get him on here.
I got to sit down with him with Guy.
Yeah, you did. Yeah. No, and he's
I was on his campaign committee in his first congressional race. I was a couple of years out of college. I'd just come back to Santa Cruz. So it has been a long relationship, and I consider that one of the best investments I ever made politically in anything, because right. He is just, you know, we were stuck when I was on the city council 30 something years ago. We were stuck in sewer treatment, and it was a question of whether we went to secondary or tertiary, and the city was doing this advanced primary, which meant you just put chemicals in the sewage and just put it right out into the ocean, and obviously we need to treat it. But the previous city administration only got us on the federal clean water list for secondary, and every activist wanted us to go to tertiary. It's a higher level of treatment. It's better for the ocean. It's better for everything. It was going to be something like $50 a month on sewer bills, and this is in $1980. And here we are, this incredibly enviro city council, and we were sued by our environmental friends because we'd only go to secondary. Well, Leon figured a way as our congressman how to get us on the water list later for tertiary, and the reason we settled the suit and went to a higher level of treatment was Leon's intervention as our congressman at the federal level.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
We're 19 days from an election being over. Do you have a schedule for 19 days of how you're
going to... This is the weirdest election I have ever been in because I've been campaigning for 22 months. And my schedule lightens up for the last 10 days because an amazing number of people will have voted already.
Right. Like you said, 20%,
yeah,
you're estimating?
20% well, have voted now.
He looks fresh.
He looks relaxed.
Yeah, he looks fresh.
I look more relaxed because the Zoom world is really different. And so In the 12 months before the March primary, I went to San Luis Obispo 25 times. And if I went to San Luis Obispo, it meant do six things down there, mm-hmm. 2.5 hours down, 2.5 hours back, yep. generally a hotel room. And now I go to San Luis Obispo every day, and then I put the top of my computer down and have dinner. It is the amount of travel. I think I've put 2 tanks of gas in in 7 months, and I had 31,000 miles on my car in the 12 months up to the primary. And so it's just a different thing. I am now walking or riding my bike really regularly because there's not this built-in exercise that goes on that you have to get in the middle of this. And my spouse is this incredible baker, so we have had pies and cookies and muffins, and I didn't even know what a galette was. You know, we've had galettes, and we're doing all this stuff, and we were about a month in, and I thought, I gotta be exercising a lot every day. This is really ridiculous.
The Corona 15 hit you?
Yeah, it hasn't, because I have exercising. Done already 10,000 steps today.
Excellent.
You know, it's real, and it's great. There's almost no place in the West Side or the downtown I haven't explored in the last 6 or 7 months. You know,
out of your district, I guess we may call this.
Which is your district again? Is where
it goes from the city of San Jose, Southern Santa Clara, Gilroy Morgan Hill, all of Santa Cruz County, coastal Monterey, including Big Sur, then this swath of 30 miles in southern Monterey County where nobody lives except for the people that you saw in Parkfield.
Parkfield,
San Ardo, San Lucas, and then all of San Luis Obispo County to the Santa Barbara County line. If you're going, there's no traffic and you're going slightly above the speed limit, it's 3 hours and 15 minutes from one end to the other.
What part of your district do you feel is in the most need, like of that you feel you could most help?
It's actually certain things in each part of the district. Are the people that were burned out in the fire and the fires are really in need. There's an issue about university growth. There's an issue about the water project in Monterey Peninsula. There's an issue that Big Sur, when it's not burning or flooding, now has 4 million people go through it a year and it's not equipped. It is just overwhelmed for the amenities. In San Luis Obispo County, Diablo Canyon, the nuclear power plant, closes in 4 years. Mm-hmm. It employs 1,700 people. It's 20% of the budget for 2 school districts through property taxes that will go off the tax rolls when it closes. So in each of those areas, there's a unique a thing that needs real help.
I saw that you got kind of beat up at a town hall over the dust.
Well, that's
air
the
quality.
Other that's the other issue in San Luis Obispo, and I'm glad you asked. It was a stunning surprise because I was going to speak to progressive women, and they turned it into a town hall on the dust issue. Mm-hmm. And what it is there's an off-road vehicle park, Oceano Dunes. It's south of Pismo Beach, and the use of it creates this dust cloud that goes across a disadvantaged community, Oceano, and then up to this mesa where a lot of people live, including some that are really well-to-do, mm-hmm. all of whom came to that meeting.
So they were organized, you're saying?
Yeah, and it was a surprise to me. They just said this is an open thing. They didn't say it was going to turn into a single-issue thing. And I did fine. I held my own, but they were just, you at state parks, you didn't fix this. You know, so they really, and the irony is I'm committed to going further than other candidates and elected officials because it's like, why should kids at a school have to shelter in place due to dust clouds? Why should people that have solar panels have to clean them every 6 weeks or else they don't work because of the dust? It is a weird physiological thing. The off-road vehicles have worn it down over time that it's really... Well, it's significant in how you couldn't get at the dust really easily right now with certain measures, and yet they're really organized. They'll turn out 1,000 people to the Coastal Commission. I just decided public health is number one.
And is it closed, that OHV
park? It happens
OHV
to be
park?
Closed right now.
Right, I heard that.
But because of COVID as much as anything. And then there's an endangered bird called the snowy plover, and there's snowy plover nest there, and they have moved over into the...
While they're closed.
Yeah, while they're closed, and state parks started to remove some of the nests of the endangered thing, and all hell broke loose, and the Coastal Commission has issued a cease and desist, and the state finally agreed to it. So,
and I thought there was some... someone had told me that there was, I guess, a couple of real bad accidents.
There have been bad.
And I heard that that had a little bit to do with it as well. But I'm sure that's
No, there's lots of issues. There's lots of issues. And I just finally decided I'm for public health. And my message to the off-road vehicle people that are like, we're being discriminated against. This is awful. This is our fun. Is you're going to lose it altogether if you don't figure out some way to get at this issue. And maybe it means part of it is closed. But you need to get at the dust issue. And some regulatory agency is going to shut the whole thing down if nobody does anything. So get it together here. And I'm willing to, you know.
Go the extra mile.
Yeah, but this is where occasionally it's great to not be from San Luis Obispo and be the senator. So, you know, I'll get in my car and go home to Santa Cruz after somebody yells at me on one side of it.
Well, I've been involved in a similar situation with Ocean Speedway at the Santa Cruz Fairgrounds. Randy Repass, who owns West Marine, sued the track over the noise after he moved a house next to the track. And he's now since moved away, but we still have the rules that he sued. And
he overlooks the track from where
he
lives. Cause
but I guess he's not there anymore. I guess he actually moved away now.
Oh, no, he's up the hill.
Oh, is he?
He's gone a lot of the time, but I had an interesting experience because I went to meet him there in this campaign. I went to have a meeting with him, and it was weird. I punched his address in the GPS, and I get to the turnoff of the highway, and it says you still have 1.7 miles to go. And I think, how is that possible? Well, that's how long his driveway is.
Wow.
You know, and he has a beautiful view. It's a gorgeous thing. He's a wonderful guy.
Oh, he is? Okay, because I've been saying bad things about him.
Well, no, he is an oceans advocate. He's really working on oceans issues, and he's a Delta fish advocate. So he really advocates for the salmon, works with the Western fisheries. So he's a good guy on environmental issues. I don't know if I'd want to have a track next to a house he lived in, because I could get that conflict.
Well, my take on it was I live next to the beach. I can't turn off the waves. I buy a house next to the Watsonville Airport. I can't ground the planes. I build a house next to a racetrack. It's been there 60 years, and now I want to close it down.
The exact same issue was when I was first on the city council with Sky Park Airport in Scotts Valley.
Yeah,
it was like this airport was in the middle of nowhere. It was very uniquely a non-contiguous inside the city limits of Santa Cruz, Sky Park Airport. And then everybody built right up to it, even propane tanks to the edge. And then they complained, you're endangering us. And it was like, well, none of you were here when the airport was built. But we closed it, much to the consternation of pilots. But it's like that's exactly the same issue.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And there's no bigger nightmare than being involved in some issue like that.
Well, because no one's going to really be ultimately happy in the end, normally. Right.
No, we had one. I hesitate to bring it up if Bill, my campaign guy, is watching. He's like, why are you going to talk about this? But the school district in Santa Cruz built field lights next to the thing without a permit. And it was just like close encounters of the third kind into neighborhood houses. And they were like, we built them. We fundraised. We did this. It's like, you've got to legalize this. And it was like, you built it without a permit. And the neighbors hate this. Why did you do this? And in the end, it got legalized through the courts. But it was like...
They did it backwards.
It's really... Those are just no-win situations.
I got one more question. You've been in politics a long time. Is there an election that's ever been more important?
No. Maybe 1860 with Abraham Lincoln, but I wasn't alive.
So,
yeah, this has got to be the most important one we ever have. I think it's between authoritarianism and making sure our democracy survives with guardrails. It is like getting us back in the Paris Climate Accords for the existential issue of our time on climate. It is getting to some sort of universal health coverage and not somebody that just thinks it's their goal in life to kick millions of people off of health care coverage. I mean, and I could just go on and on, but it's like there's just never been one with this much consequence.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And what's going to happen to the Supreme Court? I mean, it's you've fought your whole life.
No, I am, you know, in the national thing, the Republicans are trying to ask Joe Biden if he's for court packing to and it's my response would be, well, it's a question of whether the court is packed before he gets there. It's the existing right. court packing that is the issue. It's the people said you can't do it in an election year that are now doing it in the election year.
Right.
I mean, that's the issue, not something with Joe Biden.
I'm completely disgusted with Lindsey Graham.
There's a reason his opponent raised $67 million in the last quarter.
Yeah, and I know he's leading.
And there's a
reason
he's neck. No, it's neck and neck.
Oh, is it neck and neck?
It's neck and neck.
Yeah.
He could lose.
Well, it's just I feel like he's not a politician for the people.
And he was just, you know, I think I hate it because I'm an aspiring, again, elected official. I'm a public official. Nothing makes me crazier than a crook in the profession or somebody that's remotely hypocritical because it reflects on the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so to say, we would never do this in an election year, hold me accountable, and then he does it. It's like that. The hypocrisy is just shameless, you know? And so that's just like really, and my own spouse gives it to me all the time. He's like, oh, you politicians.
Well,
yeah, you know.
My wife is very non-political. She donated to Amy McGrath's campaign, you know?
Well,
and that's,
no, it's like, because Mitch McConnell is the worst.
Mm-hmm.
He is just the worst. And I think it gets to the heart of the matter, which is why are people in this? Are you in this to help people? Are you in this to bring people together? Are you in this to get constructive things done? Are you in this to be some slime ball? I can outflank your side. Who cares about the future of the country or what people believe in the system? I mean, it'll take years to undo the mistrust that comes from this particular action.
It's incredible.
You know,
yeah.
it just will. And our system of government relies on a measure of trust. It's just like our election process. Trump attacking mail ballots when he does it himself.
Right.
You know, it's like, don't undermine the system. There's almost no evidence of any significant voter fraud in the entire 50 states because we have trust in the system. And now for the first time, there's going to be more broad based lack of trust in what is a fair and honorable system. And that's the reason why this is such an important
Huge.
Election.
Well, and I laugh, too, because in the Central Valley, the GOP down there has been planting fake ballot boxes. And you're like, and Trump's up here saying it's, you know, it's like you're like, oh, my God, it's so backwards. It's really amazing. That's what makes this election so exciting.
It's important.
And exactly. We're excited to see how you finish out here in 19 days. And I know that Neil and I both hope the best, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I voted for you because I think that you can make a difference.
Well,
and I feel
that's
like
the goal.
What you just said, you listed the reasons why people do this. Now I feel like you're into this to try to bring some people together.
And believe me, we have a lot of stuff that we have to do. It's not good, whether it's the fires or sea level rise or people that don't have health care or
COVID.
We're going to have a rough time with the school system coming out of COVID.
Right.
And, you know, these are big deal in affordable housing, which we talked about. These are big. People need help.
Well, everything you just talked about is pretty much what 90% of this population is dealing with. There's very few that are completely out of the picture.
Well, I think the tough thing, the night I got elected and was sworn into the city council years and years ago, I said, you know, my goal will never forget be to forget what it's like to be on the other side of that rail. Because that was a thing that one of the things that first motivated me for the city council. I was on a charter committee, and they asked us to do it, and we did this serious thing. We presented it to us, and they just threw it in the trash can. And I was sitting there looking at it, and I thought, well, I can do a better job than they can. And it was a couple of years later when I was sitting up there, you know. But I never wanted to forget what it was like to be treated the way we were treated.
TC, I'm gonna go. He's our seasoned guest, right?
Okay.
He's one of our seasoned guests because he's got gray hair like it. Well, yeah. Like we have. So I'm gonna go with. Mr. Laird, your favorite year in politics was when and why? Okay, with UTC?
Yeah, favorite that's a year. Well, that's a new one. Yeah, because yeah. we ask our seasoned
I don't know
guests.
If there's a favorite year, but there's a favorite moment.
Love to hear that.
And I think it's when Barack Obama stepped to the microphone in Grant Park in Chicago and claimed victory. I remember I got weepy all the way through it. And it was like, wow, this is an amazing moment in time. Because there are certain times you say about certain issues, I think that'll happen in my lifetime. But deep down, you're thinking, I'm not so sure.
Right.
And it happened right there.
Right.
You know, unfortunately, there's somebody the last 4 years that's tried to undo a lot of it. But that was exciting time. That was when maybe we're as good as we say we are.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Well, for the last 4 years, I've been telling my friends, and there will be a time without Donald Trump. Now, what he's created will probably live with for decades, but he can't be
well,
here.
You know, I feel that about a lot of cataclysmic things that have happened in my life. There will be a time, like, you know, in those weeks after the earthquake, I thought, oh, will we ever be to some semblance? And we eventually got there. And I remember in the 60s, there were just horrific things and the riots and stuff, and then there got to a point that we were past it. I had maybe one closing story. There was Keith Sugar, who passed away a couple of years ago, was the mayor, I don't know, 15 years ago or something.
Yeah.
And it was a Tuesday. I read in the morning paper, and I didn't connect, that there's going to be a crowd, it was going to be messy, and they might have to arrest people in the council meeting that night. And I'm trying to get in a bike ride before sunset, and I'm sailing down West Cliff. Just, you know, it's maybe just as the sun's setting, and I see this guy that's parked in a turnout just staring off into the ocean. As I get closer, it's the mayor. And I stop and I say, oh, that's right. You have to go back and have. I said, there'll be a time when you don't even remember Tuesday night's the city council meeting.
Right.
You know, and that's this time for me. Good luck tonight. And I take off.
Right.
You know.
Well, and we call it thick skin sometimes, right? There's going to be times where. You know it'll get better.
Well, you know, you were asking about having fun. There's certain times when, you see, because one of the hardest things is to never get drawn into the cesspool by somebody that's nasty or, you know, when I was mayor, people would say, you guys couldn't administer your way out of a paper bag. Whenever they were done, I'm like, well, thank you very much. We really appreciate your input. You know? And I would always, and there was one time I finally said to a guy, you know, sir, rudeness is just not persuasive.
Well, my dad was in politics. He ran the Golden Gate Bridge for many years, and he always told me to smile and wave. You know, and whenever something gets really deep and it gets heated, just smile and wave. And I use that term all the time because
that's really great advice.
Just be nice.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Well, and I have another.
It's what the people want.
They don't come
to see people be rude to each other.
And exactly. And well, it was great having you on the show.
Yeah.
TC,
who do you want to get? You said to me.
Yeah.
A month ago. Mm-hmm. We need to get John Laird back.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is a big event in your life. And yeah. We did this show when we first started. What did we say? We just wanted to record bits of history. And here we are, 418 shows later.
Well, yeah. I'll come back for about the 450th.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about how things are going.
Yeah, you know, it's and we will have you back because we want to get an update of how it's going.
There's a teacher at Mount Madonna School, Ward Maillard, and I've spoken to his classes every year for about 20 years, and they are some of the smartest students, and they do all these trips around the world. And he said to me, he says, you know, this is really interesting for me because it's like a year's check, and I find out what you're doing, what you might have grown on, what's happening. He says, it's a check-in for me on what's happening with you. And he says, it's been fascinating to watch over 20 years as you've progressed from a local guy that went into the state, and then you headed a state agency, and you're in the middle of this. And he says, it's really interesting to watch. And so
yeah.
I'm happy for those kind of check-ins, and I hope to God it's not some disaster we don't know is coming.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know? I mean, that's sure. You can't predict it.
The last time we interviewed, I wouldn't have known what COVID was. I wouldn't have had any idea that a pandemic
COVID,
was mm-hmm. heading
on. Yeah, it was before COVID. Right. Yeah, absolutely. No, it'll be great to get that update, and we'll have you back in a year.
Thank you, sir.
You want to plug some? You want to plug some of our guys?
But thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
That's very kind. I want to thank Merch for Socks. I'm going to give some to the.
The new ones.
The new ones are hell. Yeah. I want to thank Merch for Socks. Thank you, Cindy. Chill Out Cafe. Where they? Beach Nest Vacation Rentals. If you want the perfect vacation pad in Santa Cruz, no better folks to call them. Beachnest.com. Pizza won an Aptos.
You been hitting that spot?
No. The best pizza this side of Chicago is Pizza One next to Manuel's. Mm-hmm. Jamie Jansen, Santa Cruz Core and Rehab. Went and had a massage from Abby today. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. What a doll. She has got a pair of hands on her. I also saw Numa. No, she's Gabby's the sweetheart. I bumped into Numa today from Aloha Island Grill. I asked him what the band Feather Snake's on a hiatus right now, but he wants to come down and play some solo tracks.
Excellent.
I said, come on down.
That'd be great.
I want to thank Stephanie Dutz, Steph Lutz from EXP Realty, a few yards up from the boardroom.
There's a lot of cars in that place.
Is it? She's doing good. If you think you're moving, now is the time to sell. Call Steph to list your home today. Calling all buyers, she said interest rates are low and lower than ever. Is that true?
Yeah, it's like 3.
I think they are. So even though house prices are a bit high, with low interest rates, it's still a time to buy. Work from home, buy the ocean. Call her at 831-345-8755. The Kayak Connection, stop by and saw Jess from the Kayak Connection. They got a whole new
building over there.
Whole new thing out. Yeah. So they've extended it. Mm-hmm. It's a great time, especially with the weather. How about the weather today?
Yeah, great way to social distance.
Yep, great way to get some exercise and social distance. The Kayak Connection, the Santa Cruz and Moss Landing. Rogue Pies. I want to thank Ed from Rogue Pies.
I'm ready for my Rogue Pie, by the way.
Have you not had one yet?
No.
Okay, I'm delivering. So I'm going to bring some to you. I surfed with him the other day. He drove in the parking lot, and I stood there with my paddleboard in my hand, above my hand. He's like, shh. He's coming down. I told him you want to talk to him.
Dude.
I told him you have an issue.
Hey, I want to see the bracelet.
Yeah, he's bringing the bracelet. That's Sean Rovi from Farmers Insurance. Yes, he continues to steal my waves. He's a great guy.
Well,
462-322-2222.
Because he's wearing a shark bracelet around his ankle.
Yeah.
Do you hang out near him now?
Yeah, but he's like.
Are you burning each other more because you're hanging around the anti-shark bracelet? Is that what happens out there? Is there a crowd around him now?
No,
because
because.
Got the bracelet
no,
on?
There's not a crowd. Because everyone knows it's bullshit.
Okay.
The delicious Holy Smokes Barbecue. I went in there the other day, dude. That's another place I can't eat, though. They sponsor the show, but I cannot eat there. Maybe 400 pounds.
Yeah.
I had nothing. I left.
Oh,
I ran out.
The last time you ate there, what did you have?
I haven't eaten there yet. Janice goes, come on down. Give me some ribs. It's like 1 in the afternoon, and she's ready to give me a side of cow.
You know what? Next week or the week after, let's grab some ribs. We can show them off on the show.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. I want to thank, TC, you got a new sponsor. Love to surf and poach all my waves. Another one. Her name is Jenny Medved, who's been surfing in all my spots when she's not selling real estate for Compass Real Estate, both here in Santa Cruz as well as over in Silicon Valley. I can't give her too much of a bad time. She now supports the show. Her testimonials on her website are full of extreme high praise. For your real estate needs, allow me to just suggest a call to Jenny at 408-569-4591.
Fantastic.
And who did I miss?
Fig. Yeah.
Fig. I hope Fig was watching tonight. Did he say something?
No.
Anyway, once again, I want to thank John Laird for coming on the show tonight. Next time he comes,
best of luck as we finish up these next 19 days.
So next time he comes on the show, which is be after the election,
yes.
Do you think he'll still be in like shorts and flip flops or a little more formal?
Well, it depends on what day of the week we get him.
Thank you,
and
sir.
I can
tell you which way I'd want to come.
Yeah.
How important is it to vote once more?
Make sure you vote. And it is not hard if you've never voted by mail. You mark your ballot with an ink pen. You rip the top off. You put it in an envelope, you sign it in a recognizable signature, date it, and you drop it off at a drop-off site or mail it in a secure U.S. mailbox. Really easy to do. And sooner the better, so that it gets counted way ahead.
Love it. And I went down and dropped mine at the county building.
Easy.
Easy as could be.
Easy peasy.
So did I. That's what I did.
It was great.
Thanks, sir. Thank you, sir. Thank you very, very much.